Well, if you want to follow along this morning, we're going to be in Exodus 3 and 4. Some of the scriptures will appear on the screen, some of them will not, and we're going to cover a lot of territory today. So you're welcome to follow along, or you're just welcome to sit back and kind of listen and enjoy the ride as we go along. But it's good for us to be together, and it's great for us to be here and to hear this message from the Lord. Thank you to Oscar for reading the long scripture reading this morning and for taking us through that story. So we're going to be in Exodus chapter 3. And as we start this morning, I want you to reflect on a quick question. What might God be calling you to? For Moses, as we start our story this morning, life is pretty comfortable. Not at all what he'd pictured growing up in Pharaoh's household, but comfortable. You see, when Moses was born, he escaped something terrible. Pharaoh, in essence, ordered a genocide. He ordered that all the Israelite baby boys should be killed. But thanks to his quick-thinking mother and his watchful sister, something incredible happened. The boy who was supposed to die by the hands of Pharaoh's orders is instead found by Pharaoh's own daughter floating in the river. And then he becomes her adopted son. Now, how ironic is that? Moses grows up in the palace of Pharaoh. He's taught to live like an Egyptian. He dresses like the royalty. He's probably groomed for a position of power in the government. Now, Moses knows he will never, ever be Pharaoh. That's simply out of the question. But he probably could get some cushy job somewhere, overseeing a financial or military or agricultural or governmental position. That would make life pretty nice. But everything changed for Moses one day. Moses had always known he was an outsider. His own mother had been the one who raised him for a time. And when he was young, she would tell him stories all about his people and his heritage. And he always knew he looked a little bit different than the other Egyptians. Moses knew that he belonged, and yet he also didn't. For he knew he was one of the Israelite people, the people he saw enslaved as workers and laborers and builders. And one day while he was watching, an Egyptian overseer started to beat a Hebrew slave within an inch of his life. Now, Moses has an anger problem. That's probably actually putting it very bluntly, very poorly. And in anger, Moses looks around, he makes sure no one is watching, and he intervenes. And he kills the Egyptian, buries him in the sand, and thinks, hey, I got away with it. But the very next day, Moses realizes that his secret isn't so secret after all. The thing that he thought he'd hidden was known by everyone, and now Pharaoh is going to put him to death. And so Moses flees into the desert. And at the age of 40, Moses' entire life has changed. He goes from a position of power to being a wanted fugitive overnight. There in the desert, Moses meets a young woman by the name of Zipporah, the daughter of the priest of Midian. They marry and they have a son, and Moses settles into a life of shepherding. In fact, he says, I have become a foreigner in a foreign land. Now, life isn't what Moses originally had in mind, but it is settled. It's safe. It's secure. He no longer has these grand ambitions for his life. The old part of his life is over and is put away. No longer is he Moses, the adopted grandson of Pharaoh. Now he is simply Moses, the shepherd. Once confident and self-assured, Moses is now full of confusion and self-doubt. And that's who he stays for the next 40 years. But God has other plans in store for this man. For Moses' entire world is turned upside down one day on a mountainside. Moses is out tending sheep as he normally does. He's taken them all over in search of good grazing ground, and they've come to the far western side of the wilderness. And Moses is just literally minding his own business when he sees something strange, a bush that's burning on the hillside. Now, for those of us who know this story, we know what's taking place. We know what's happening. It says this, "There an angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within the bush." But Moses is simply encountering this for the first time. He has no idea what's taking place. In a land devoid of water, fire is risky business. And so he says, I will go over and see the bush that the fire is not burning up. Curiosity makes him take a closer look. And when the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, "Moses, Moses." And Moses answered, "Here I am." Now, Moses doesn't have a clue as to what's going on. And to be frank, I'm a little bit amazed by this story. Just think about it for a moment. The bush starts to speak. And the bush not only speaks, but the bush knows his name. And Moses answers. Okay, now, does anyone else find this odd? This is a weird little story. He doesn't really know what's going on. He doesn't know what he's seeing. He doesn't know what he's supposed to do. And so God clues him in. And God says, "Don't come any closer. Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground." And then he said, "I am the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham and of Isaac and of Jacob." And Moses' next reaction shows that he finally understands. And at this, Moses hides his face, for he is afraid to look at God. Now, I want you to put yourself in Moses's, okay, we can't say shoes here because he's taken them off, but let's put ourselves in Moses's position for a moment. You're simply going through life, minding your own business, when your entire existence is transformed by an encounter with God. What would you be thinking and how would you be feeling? I think I would be fearful here. I would have trepidation. I'd have awe and reverence and respect and confusion and questioning. What does God want with me? Why is God appearing to me? My father-in-law is the priest, not me. I'm barely even an Israelite. I'm more Egyptian than Israelite. That's how I was raised. And really, for the last 40 years, I'm more Midianite than anything else. I'm not important. I'm not holy. So why is God here? I can imagine his feelings, but God continues on with the explanation. And the Lord says, "I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I've heard them crying because of their slave drivers, and I'm concerned of their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and bring them up out of the land that is out of that land and into a land that is good and spacious, a land flowing with milk and honey." Sure, a land filled with all these other peoples. "But the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I've seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them." God tells Moses that he has been close by, that he has seen the misery of Israel, that he has heard their crying. In Exodus 2:24, a passage we read last week, we're told God heard their groaning and remembered his covenant with Abraham and with Isaac and with Jacob. And in Hebrew thought, the word "to remember" also comes with a secondary understanding, because to remember is to act. And so God is about to act. And at first we have to wonder, okay, God, why has this taken so long? Why have you not done something before now? But consider this for just a moment, because I think that Exodus 3 is the perfect moment for God to act. God is choosing now because he's prepared the very person that he wants and is now ready to go. Look back at the life of Moses. See it again with fresh eyes with me for a moment. Because God has already been at work behind the scenes since the very beginning. Moses is an Israelite whose life starts in the midst of genocide. Yet he's spared in a miraculous way. He survives in the midst of the Nile River and is pulled out by the daughter of Pharaoh himself, the very person who is calling for the genocide. And Moses becomes that Egyptian prince, raised in the house of Pharaoh, yet also schooled in the ways of his own people. And he spends 40 years of his life with a dual identity. And then Moses becomes a shepherd in the desert. He learns how to protect and how to lead. He learns how to survive in harsh conditions. He becomes a desert dweller. And if anyone is ready to lead the Israelites, it's a fellow Israelite. If anyone can take on Pharaoh, it's somebody who is raised alongside of Pharaoh. If anyone can lead a stubborn people through the desert, it's a shepherd who knows what it takes to survive in the desert. Moses' training is now complete, and his mission is about to begin. And so God says, "So now, go. Go. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt." And Moses' response is a big nah. It's not going to happen. Moses denies God's call. He doesn't want to go. And so he's going to try every way he can to get out of it. And so Moses' first denial, as we read this morning, stems from self-doubt. Because his very next statement to God is this: who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? Who am I? I'm unimportant. I have no sway or influence. Moses' first denial comes from his own self-doubt. But then God tells Moses, it's not about you. It's all about God. Because in chapter 3, verse 12, he says, I will be with you. Moses, just trust, because I, the Lord your God, will be with you. But that doesn't convince him. And Moses' second denial comes then from a lack of trust in God himself. Okay, you say you will be with me, but, verse 13, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. And they ask me, what's his name? Then what shall I tell them? In essence, Moses is saying, God, I don't really know you. I'm not sure I can trust you. And then really underneath that argument is also this: seriously, God, I don't want to do it. Send somebody else. And God's response is one of the most telling statements in all of the Bible. God tells his very name and its meaning. And to be frank, I have a really hard time glossing over this. This is the most significant portion in the Old Testament in many ways by far. And we're going to hit it in 30 seconds. But God says to Moses, I am who I am. This is what you were to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. And then say to the Israelites, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. And this is my name forever, the name you shall call me from generation to generation. For the first time in the Bible, God reveals his name to his people. This is Hashem, as they say in Hebrew, or the name. You'll also hear it called by Latin the Tetragrammaton, the four letters. It's a name that's considered so holy that Jews and even some Christians will not say the name itself, replacing it with phrases like the Lord. And the name Yahweh comes from a condensed form of a Hebrew phrase that means I am who I am, or I am he who is, or I am what I will be, or there's about four other ways you can translate it as well. But God's name signifies his presence. God's name signifies his being. God's name signifies his action. It's a promise that God is and is faithful and is acting for his people. And so God sends a message from himself through Moses to the leaders of Israel. I have heard your cry. I have watched over you, and I am about to act. And I'm going to bring you to the land that I promised. But first, I'm going to have to make Pharaoh let you go. But once again, Moses doubts. And we have his third denial. And that third denial is based on his doubting of his own people. He says this in verse 1 of chapter 4. What if they do not believe me or listen to me? And they say, the Lord did not appear to you. Again, it seems that Moses is doubting himself and his ability also to convince his people. And so God gives him three signs. Throw your staff on the ground, it will become a snake. Stick your hand into your pocket and pull it out, and it will be leprous. That sounds horrendous. And then if none of that works, then pour some water out from the Nile, and it will turn into blood. And these signs will convince your people. But again, Moses says, I don't want to do it. I have no desire. And so he denies for a fourth time. Down in verse 10, Moses said to the Lord, pardon your servant God. I have never been eloquent, neither in the past nor since you have spoken to me as your servant. I am slow of speech and of tongue. In other words, God, I don't speak too good. But I love God's response. Who gave human beings their mouths? Or who makes them deaf or mute? Who gives them sight or makes them blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now go, I will teach, help you speak and teach you what to say. God is saying, seriously? I made mouths and tongues. I think I can make yours work. But finally, Moses cries out in exasperation, pardon your servant, Lord. Please send somebody else. I don't want to go. Seriously, God, I'm done with this argument. I am happy and content here. I have a decent job. I have a nice family. I'm 80 years old. I don't want to go. Just let me be. How many times do I have to refuse before you take the hint? Just 2 weeks ago, Hannah started saying the word no. It's a fun and wonderful time for a parent. And when she's really emphatic, it comes out as a D, so it's do. And then we know she really doesn't want to do it. So, Hannah, let's brush your teeth. Do. Hannah, it's time for bed. Do. Hannah, take one more bite. Do. Hannah, can I use you as a sermon illustration? Do. Okay, I broke that one. I apologize. But she's laughing along with us. Look at that. Hannah, do you want more chocolate cake? Do. Wait. And then she usually nods after that one. Now, it started off really cute. Yes, it did. And now it's kind of frustrating. I love her anyway, don't get me wrong. And it's also kind of how I picture Moses here. He's 80 years old, but his responses are rather childish. No. No, I don't want to go. No one will listen to me. No one will follow me. I'm not very good at what you're asking me to do. I don't want to do it. Just ask somebody else. No. Amen. It seems childish when it's put that way, doesn't it? Yet it's the very same way that I came to ministry. In high school, I felt like God was calling me to go and do ministry. My youth ministers had put me in positions in which they were asking me to be a leader and encouraging me to speak and to share and to lead. But I told God, I want to make money. I don't want to be a minister. And so I went to college to study medicine. Now, there's nothing wrong with studying medicine, okay? Let's not go there. But I continued to feel called towards ministry. Friends kept hinting that's what I should do. Teachers began to move me in that direction. Ministers from my home church kept asking me to come back and to preach sermons with them. But still I told God, absolutely not. Finally, after 3 or 4 years of arguing with God in college, I said, you know what? I'll pick up a vocational ministry degree and I'll go on to grad school. But there's two things I want here. I don't ever want to be a teacher. And I don't ever want to preach in the pulpit. And God has a funny sense of humor. And ever since that time, there are times in my life when I keep trying to escape from ministry. And God keeps bringing me back. God's yeses keep outweighing my no's because God knew what was best for me. God kept calling me into ministry. And God keeps calling Moses to leadership. And after 5 times of denial, God finally tells Moses, seriously, just listen to me, just go, and I will be with you. When God called, Moses was forced to answer. So what might God be calling you to? The idea of calling is a central tenet of Christianity. Christians are a called people. For God is calling each of us to come and be united with Him. All people are called to come and to be God's children, regardless of their background and their baggage. God calls them to Himself through Christ. God calls us to be saints, people who are sanctified by Christ and being made more like Him. And as we started our service this morning, God then calls us to live out that faith in our lives, to lead a life worthy of the calling that we have received. As Christians, we are a called people, and our faith is our vocation. The word vocation comes from the Latin terms vocatio, which means a sense of calling. Too often we think of our occupation as our vocation. Our work and our career, that thing we do each week in order to earn enough money to take home, becomes our identity. But that thing is our job, not necessarily our calling. And when we equate that which pays the bills with who we are, then our job becomes our identity. I am a manager, I am a teacher, I am an accountant, I am a nurse. But that often misses the point. Studs Terkel, that's a great name, by the way. Studs Terkel was a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. And his favorite thing to do was to go around and interview normal, everyday people and then draw conclusions from those conversations. Studs Terkel was a sociologist long before sociology was cool. And in his book, Working, he spoke to a woman named Nora. And Nora was reflecting on her job and on work in general when she made this statement. Jobs are not big enough for people. It's not just the assembly line worker whose job is too small for his spirit, you know. And I love that statement. Because it reminds us, although some of us feel really called to our professions, many of us don't. It's just that thing that we do. And when we equate our calling with our career, we miss out on an important part of God's mission in our lives. I love what Frederick Buechner, an American theologian, said about vocation. He says this, "Vocation means the work a person is called to by God. And there are all kinds of different voices calling you to all different kinds of work. And the problem is to find out which is the voice of God rather than that of society, say, or the superego, or of self-interest. The kind of work God usually calls you to is the work where A, you need to do, and B, that the world needs to have done. The place God calls you to is the place where your deep gladness and the world's deep hunger meet." And I love that statement. Now, I want you to hear me plainly this morning. I'm not telling you to go into work tomorrow and quit your job. Okay? Please. I'm not calling you to a career change or to take some time off to find yourself. Okay? But I am asking us to begin to think about our calling in terms of more than what we do on Monday through Friday. Our calling might be our career. Or our career might just be the thing that we do to pay the bill so that we can do the thing to which God is calling us and directing us. What might God be calling you to? And think about the statement that's there on the screen. What might God want you to do, to become, to be, to accomplish? Maybe you feel called by God to share your faith with those who don't know about God. So you could begin by just loving your neighbors, or starting a Bible study at a local coffee shop, or volunteering here with FriendSpeak. Maybe you feel called to change the life of a child, so sign up to teach a Bible class here at the church, or mentor a student through Impact, or look into foster care or adoption. Maybe you feel called to serve the least of these, so grab some friends, some food, and make some sandwiches to go out and feed the homeless, or stop and talk to the lonely widow down the street. What do you feel called to? Our calling is often the thing that God puts on our hearts and that He keeps bringing us back to. Something that is godly, let's emphasize that, and that reminds us of Him. And something that gives God all the glory. Like Moses, it's easy to tell God no. We might do it from self-doubt or from denial. We might say no because we're comfortable or complacent. We might tell God it's the wrong time or He chose the wrong person or we aren't talented enough for what He wants. But what might happen if we stop for a moment and decide to listen and to follow God's call? What might happen if we allow God's yeses to outweigh our no's? How might our lives be changed? How might our world be changed? All because we're willing to listen to God's call. Christians are a called people. And that starts with our calling to Christ. Because God bids that anyone who is willing should come and receive His gift of salvation, the gift of grace that none of us can earn, that none of us can do enough to get, but it's a free gift of God. And He's saying, just come and follow Me. And when we unite our lives to Christ, then He begins to call us to become more than we could be without Him. He begins to work in our hearts and our lives to change us and mold us and make us more like Him. And then He calls us to live out our faith, to love other people. And this morning, if there's any way we can help you answer that call, we'd love to do it. If we can help introduce you to Christ, we'd love to be the opportunity for you to come and to hear His call. Or if you need to just have prayers that God would make His call more evident in your life, we're happy to stop and pray for you. Or if you need to just have something prayed over that's keeping you from following God, we're happy to do that as well. Or if you just want to rejoice with us this morning, hey, that's great. We'd be happy to do that and share that. But that's why this time of invitation is here. It's a chance for you, if you would like, to answer God's call in a public way. And if not, come and see some of us afterwards if you still have something on your heart, and we'd be happy to stop and pray with you and talk with you. But if there's any way we can bless you today, come to the front as we stand and as we sing together.